Cool Blue Tomb by Paul Kimprikos, narrated by Barry Campbell. Chapter 1. The day had been a scorcher from first light, hot and muggy, mercury in the 90s, sticky shirt weather, when the skin prickles between the shoulder blades, underwear clings like a damp dishcloth to every body crease, and tempers go on hair trigger. The sun had awakened with a grudge against the world, and no one was sorry to see it go. As the molten disk disappeared, finally, behind the western horizon, a collective sigh of relief arose, from the Cape Cod Canal to Provincetown, like a family watching the departure of a bad-tempered rich uncle. Out at Race Point, the sunset watchers held their breath, half expecting the sun to sizzle as it plunged into the sea, but there was no steam, only a silent, gilt-edged explosion of red and orange and a violet darkness. Then came a chorus of honking horns. Applause rippled over the sand dunes like opening night at a Broadway spectacular, and the watchers headed out in the dusk, crossing the quiet desert hills of the province lands to the bright lights and noise of Commercial Street. The narrow lane skirting Provincetown Harbor was mobbed. From the Art Association building to the Coast Guard station, a single line of cars crept, bumper to bumper, through the milling foot traffic. Tourists shuffled lethargically along in the lingering tropical heat, faces glistening with perspiration, searching for a cool breeze, but willing to settle for the diversions offered by the eclectic variety of bars, cafes, and shops. Long queues formed outside the soft ice cream stands. The hot oven pizza joints were as lively as morgues, and the patrons in the sidewalk cafes didn't mind paying $3.50 for a dollar beer as long as the glass was cold. From his window seat in a smoky East End bistro, the blonde man stared at the passing street parade. His expression fluctuated, boredom, then annoyance, then boredom again. In between, he glanced impatiently at his wristwatch. A half dozen empty bottles of Black Horse Ale stood on his table, and he was working on another, chasing down each quick gulp with an angry puff on a Marlboro cigarette. He checked his watch again. Then he frowned, mashed the cigarette into an ashtray overflowing with half-smoked butts, and got up, bumping into a young woman at the next table. She was drinking a Cape Codder, cranberry juice and vodka. The icy red mixture sloshed from her glass onto her lap, and she yelped angrily. The blonde man ignored her and staggered off. He was in his mid-30s, and his well-tanned face had a boyishness that fooled people until they got close enough to see the hardness around the thin lips and green-flecked gray eyes. His hair was platinum, near white, and shoulder-length like a 1960s flower child. He wore faded blue jeans, cut off at the thigh in a ragged fringe, and a purple t-shirt. The shirt was decorated in silver with swaying palms and the words, "Life's a beach." His tattooed arms were thick and muscular. His narrow waist came up in a V to shoulders almost too broad for his medium height, like the physique Charles Atlas used to peddle to 95-pound weaklings from the back cover of Superman comic books. The dim room was jammed with sweaty college kids smelling of sunscreen, unshaven Portuguese fishermen wearing black shin-high boots, and gay couples and threesomes of both sexes. Foamy pitchers of beer swirled over the sea of heads like flotsam caught in a current. A couple of air conditioners with persistent death rattles spat drops of water and battled futilely against the BTU level produced by the press of bodies. The jukebox pounded out a Rolling Stones number, "Sympathy for the Devil." Mick Jagger's satanic guttural voice cutting through the din, and the Stones chanting like a chorus of deranged owls. The blonde man shoved a path through the crowd to the restrooms marked "Buoys and Gulls." The men's room door was locked. He swore to himself, then pushed his way to the rear of the long bar. He stepped outside and descended a short stairway to the beach. Walking unsteadily in the soft sand, he picked his way around the rotting hulk of an old wooden fishing boat, stopped in the shadow of an abandoned pier, and relieved himself at the water's edge. He zipped up his fly and tarried, savoring the coolness of a light breath of air that whispered off the bay. Across the bay, fishing draggers sidled alongside the fish pier to disgorge the slimy contents of their holds. The breeze died after a moment, and the blond man turned to go. Before he had taken a step, the cement truck hit him. That's what it felt like, something big and heavy smashing into his spine, hurtling him forward like a missile thrown from a catapult. He sprawled face down, hearing his raspy breath, someone moving behind him, the fishing boat engines mumbling like old men, the jukebox blasting. Planting his arms in the ankle-deep water, he struggled to push himself to a kneeling position. A boot slammed into his right elbow. Hot pain shot through his arm and it crumpled like cellophane. He flopped back into the water. The boot crashed into the side of his head. Then again. The harbor lights blinked out. And a voice from the jukebox shouted, "Oh yeah!" Buffeted by green waves of nausea, the blond man groped for a handhold at the slippery edge of consciousness. After several unsuccessful tries, he held on, and the world slowly came into glassy focus. His head and arm throbbed with a dull ache. He lay belly down, his face turned to the left on a flat, hard surface that shivered with the low-end vibration of a powerful engine. There was a damp, fishy smell in the air and the shush-shush of a bow cutting water. He was on a boat, that was clear. How the hell? He remembered leaving the bar to take a leak, then nothing. He tried to move, but his legs were bound securely. His left arm was pinioned to his thigh, his right hand curled uncomfortably up by his ear. A weight pressed down on his back. He shuddered as the faint light of comprehension glimmered in a corner of his mind. Jesus, he was wearing diving gear. The weight on his back was an air tank. He was looking through the window of a face mask. The second skin clinging to his body was a dive suit. Panic clawed at his innards. Why in God's name was he fitted out for a dive? He fought against the icy fear, taking deep and measured breaths to still the frantic jackhammering of his heart. Be cool, man. Don't struggle. Don't lose your head. You've been in tough spots before, black water with minutes of air, your regulator hose snagged on a jagged hull. Be cool. Think. He rocked back and forth, gaining momentum with each motion, and finally managed to roll onto his right side. There was a hollow gong as the air tank banged into the deck. He tried to free an arm. It was impossible. He was wrapped as tightly as a mummy. He squirmed helplessly, like a beached eel, but the bindings holding him were incredibly strong. After a few minutes of desperate effort, he lay on his side, panting and exhausted. Sweat stung his eyes. His nausea had returned. The engine pitch changed from a rumble to a murmur. The boat lost headway and settled into the seas like a ballerina. Footsteps approached and stopped inches from his head. Rubber boots gleamed wetly in the faint yellow wash of deck lights. Hands reached down and grabbed him under the armpits. He was dragged a short distance and released. The slap of waves against the hull was louder. The hands reached down again and pulled his legs so the fins dangled over the side of the deck. "No!" he shouted. A boot thudded against his shoulder. He teetered for a long, terrifying instant. The boot battered him again. He rolled off into space and splashed headfirst into the chill sea. A hoarse scream escaped from his throat, but the words were lost in a garbled burst of bubbles. He began to sink into blackness. The immense weight of the sea closed in, welcoming him with an inexorable killing embrace that crushed his useless lungs. Daggers of pain stabbed his ear canals. He continued to sink, ever deeper. The contractions of his dying body had come to a fitful halt by the time he landed on the soft, muddy bottom. The impact stirred up a cloud of silt and sent several crabs scuttling for safety. The body settled into the thick, grassy carpet of vegetation. In time, the cloud subsided, the crabs returned, and the body rested quietly in its lightless cradle, becoming one with its surroundings. Then, brushed by a gentle current, the long, pale strands of hair began to rise and fall, moving in rhythmic concert with the undulating fingers of seaweed. Chapter 2. Be content with your lot. Aesop says, you can't be first in everything. Old Aesop was a fantastic teller of fables, no doubt about it, and generally his advice isn't half bad. Slow and steady wins the race, or don't count your chickens before they've hatched, still makes good sense after 2,500 years. But contentment was eluding me on this stormy day, the third in a row. I lazed on a moldy green sofa and nursed my next-to-last can of Bud. The beer had gone flat, but I didn't care. Slurping another tepid mouthful, I reached over and picked up a comics section page from last Sunday's Globe, read the Doonesbury strip and didn't think it was funny, crumpled a page in a ball, then tossed it at a Boston Celtics wastebasket, imagining I was Larry Bird. 3 seconds left in the game. Tie score. Bird steals the ball. The crowd is on its feet. Johnny Most is yelping with excitement in the announcer's booth. Bird drives down the parquet floor. He shoots. The ball arcs prettily toward the basket. Punk. It bounced off the metal edge and joined the pile of wrinkled newspaper littering the floor. Rimshot. Phooey. Absent-mindedly scratching the dark stubble that made an emery board of my chin, I read for at least 100th time the embroidered motto that mocked me from the opposite wall. Home, sweet home. My gorge rose. If I weren't a civilized person, and I hadn't paid 15 cents for the framed sampler at a yard sale, if it weren't covering a hole in the plaster, I would have ripped it from the wall and stomped the words to shreds. Instead, I dolefully surveyed my surroundings and sighed. The boathouse smelled as if it had floated ashore at high tide. The incessant sound of raindrops splattering like machine gun bullets against the window panes echoed in my skull. I looked fearfully toward the heavens every time the timbers shivered from the battering force of a southeast gust, half expecting the roof to fly off. The dank air was wet enough for a fish to swim in. A viscous slime coated the linoleum floors like some alien space blob out of a 50s horror movie. I glanced at the shaggy, overweight black cat attached to my thigh. He was mildewing around the whiskers and tail, but he purred happily in his sleep. At least one of us had found contentment. I was mind-weary and bored. Even worse, I was broke. The dirty weather was more than just a nuisance. It meant no fishing and no paycheck. I pried the cat from my leg without disturbing his noisy snooze, stood up and walked over to the deck doors. On clear days, there's a panoramic view of the bay, the low-lying dunes of the outer beach and the liquid immensity of the Atlantic Ocean stretched to world's end. Today, sheets of rain slanted down from slag-gray skies and cut visibility to a few yards. I closed my eyes and concentrated, willing the rain and wind to stop and the sun to break through the clouds. The phone rang. I guess that was something. I opened my eyes and picked it up.
"How you doing, Sock?"
A voice as crisp as dry leaves. Sam, my fishing partner.
"Lousy, Sam. How about you?" "Yeah, I know what you mean. Still looks a little sloppy, don't it?"
Sam's lyrical description of the tempest raging outside was in character. His gift for Yankee understatement had surfaced the first winter we fished together. We were coming into harbor, loaded to the gills with cod, when his line trawler lost speed and sunk into a trough between two big waves. A following sea, taller than the radio antennae, slammed into Sam's boat like a locomotive. We could have pitch-poled end over end and landed in the breakers wearing a couple thousand pounds of codfish for hats, but the Atlantic Ocean was merely reminding us it was boss, and we escaped that day with only a cold shower. Minutes later, soaked to the skin, we entered more placid waters. Sam was at the wheel. He looked up with a puckish expression of unconcern on his ruddy features.
"Lost a little headway back there,"
he observed casually, ignoring the water that dripped off the tip of his nose. Now he was quoting the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration weather report. It was good news for a change. Rain would end, wind would drop, and come around to the southwest. We could fish tomorrow.
That's great, Sam, I said. I'll see you down at the pier, bright and early. Sam answered with the fisherman's catch-all word for everything good and wonderful. Finest kind, he said. Life had taken on new meaning. This called for a celebration. I hung up and liberated my last can of Bud from the refrigerator. I was in mid-swallow when the phone rang again. Probably Sam calling to tell me how his old crewman once lost his false teeth overboard and found them in a goosefish. I hadn't heard that story more than a dozen times. It wasn't Sam. I put the beer down quickly. Hi, Ma, I said.
Hello, Aristotle. Have you been away?
No, I've been home more than a week.
Have you been sick?
No, Ma. Why do you ask?
You haven't called. You haven't come home to visit, so you must be sick.
The Socratic method at work. Asking a series of easily answered questions, leading the answerer to a logical conclusion foreseen by the questioner. Oh, hell. No, I've been fine. I'm sorry. I've been pretty busy lately. You know how it is.
Yes, of course, Aristotle. I understand. Maybe sometime when you are not busy, your father and I will see you.
The years have scarcely touched my mother's voice. It has just enough trace of an accent to be charming and is nearly as rich and melodious as I remember as a kid, yet it carries an unmistakable message of command. Not a pattern, more subtle. My childhood buddies worried about being spanked. I would have welcomed a swat on the behind as relatively painless. My misdeeds, however trivial, were considered stains on family honor. A raised eyebrow would cut me down to size. A pause after a sentence would have me squirming. It still did. I know, I said hastily. It's an amazing coincidence having you call. There's no fishing because of the weather, so I was just thinking of coming up to see you and Pop today.
Kala, Aristotle, good. That will make Papa and me very happy. Drive safely, she added,
and hung up. I put the phone down and finished my beer, not really enjoying it, then went into the bathroom to shower my gamey body and scrape the weeds off my face. I exchanged my denim cutoffs for a wrinkled but clean pair of tan chinos, my t-shirt for a blue Oxford cloth button-down, and my flip-flops for a pair of topsiders worn over bare feet. It was still raining, so I pulled on a slicker and a Boston Red Sox baseball cap. I walked outside and swung behind the wheel of a faded green GMC half-ton pickup truck in the advanced stages of body rot. The engine turned over a few times, reluctantly, and coughed to a sputtering start. I put the truck into gear and followed a half-mile-long dirt road to the macadam, splashing through puddles as big as Lake Superior. Actually, I was glad of an excuse to overcome my personal inertia and get off Cape Cod. The boathouse was as unfit for human habitation as a fever swamp. Acute claustrophobia had reached a near-terminal stage. And my sole foray into town to replenish my shrinking beer supply ended with a panicky and empty-handed retreat. Mobs of foul-tempered tourists who had fled their expensive cottages and motel rooms were driving aimlessly around with carloads of whiny kids in the back seat and murder in their hearts. The merchants loved lousy weather because people don't go to the beach. The cash registers jingle merrily on rainy days, but the Cape is a traffic jungle. The rain was tapering off 45 minutes later as the truck passed under the parabolic steel framework of the Sagamore Bridge, one of three spans linking the Cape to the mainland. Far below, visible through the suicide fence, a rusty freighter sluggishly plowed a foamy furrow between the curving stone revetments of the Cape Cod Canal, fighting the stiff currents that rippled the wide waterway. 2 hours later, I was about 25 miles northwest of Boston, looking at the far smaller Northern Canal, the three-decker houses and sprawling brick mill buildings of my hometown on the Merrimack River. The Chamber of Commerce boosters have taken to calling Lowell the Cinderella City. The old place had come a long way, but its story was hardly the stuff of glass slippers. It was more like the bank president who became a Skid Row bum than claws his way back to respectability. In its heyday, before the turn of the century, Lowell was the world model for the industrial town. Then came the Depression. The mills closed, and Lowell went into a funk that lasted more than 50 years.
A local boy named Jack Karuk made it big before drowning in a sea of booze and hopelessness, and the inevitability of his fate seemed like a metaphor for the city. In the 1970s, high-tech and new political clout sparked a comeback. Today, instead of bone-tired immigrants toiling over clattering looms in the old mills, there were trendy boutiques, upscale ice cream stores, and National Park Service rangers telling gaggles of school kids how it was. The old ethnic groups who really knew how it was had left the city to the newcomers, mostly Southeast Asians, all trying to carve their piece of the American dream and not doing badly at it. There were big changes in the Acre, the neighborhood where I loitered with my buddies and shredded the warm summer evenings with rock music from our car radios. The golden-domed Holy Trinity Hellenic Orthodox Church and the Hellenic Cultural Center were unchanged, but gone was the Greek grocery store on Market Street, where you could buy dark, wrinkled olives from strong-smelling tubs and juicy roast lamb slivered with garlic and wrapped in heavy white butcher paper. In its place was a Southeast Asian import business. The corner gift shop that sells baklava and miniature Parthenons is flanked by a couple of Cambodian stores. The kids who play in the nearby housing project have black hair and eyes and round faces. Garbage litters the sidewalks, and a couple of tough-looking bars that look like the last stop on the Muscatel Express have managed to hang on. The air vibrates with a nervous Asian energy, though, and big American cars line the curbs. Near the edge of town, I parked outside a converted three-story brick mill building. I stepped through the front entrance into a reception room and inhaled an overpowering fragrance of oregano, cheese, and tomato. Athena Costas was seated behind a reception desk. Seeing her triggered pleasant memories. I'd had a crush on Athena when we were both kids struggling to learn old country language and culture in the church Greek school. She was a few pounds heavier now, and her black hair was touched by gray, but her dark almond-shaped eyes were still strikingly beautiful. I remember my pang of teenage lust the time the back of her blouse lost a button. She looked up and smiled. "Hi, Sock. How are things down on the Cape?" I went behind the desk, impulsively pecked her cheek, just for old times, and said, "Busy, Thina. You look terrific. Is the family around?" She blushed faintly. "Thanks, I needed that. It's been one of those days. They're out back. Be prepared. They're having an, marketing session." I squeezed her shoulder and stepped into an adjoining office dominated by an enormous color photograph of the Acropolis in all its magnificent ruin. Under the picture, in the delft blue of the Greek national flag, were the words Parthenon Pizza. One out of every three frozen pizzas sold in New England is a Parthenon. Try a classic. A door next to the poster flew open, and an apparition in white burst in. White sneakers, white slacks, white t-shirt, and white arms. Face and mustache caked with enough flour to bake a week's supply of rolls at the Parker House. My younger brother looked as if he had fallen into a flour bin, which was probably what happened. "Hi, George," I said.
"Sock," he gasped breathlessly, sending up a powdery cloud of flour. "You gotta come and settle an argument. I just read Pa's order for Southeastern Mass. It's huge. He's crazy. Linguica pizza's a new product, for God's sake."
"I don't know, George. Lots of people in New Bedford and Fall River can't get through their breakfast without frying up a few hunks of sausage with their eggs, so they'll have an early start on the day's heartburn. Maybe Pa's right." Speak of the devil, George was brushed aside by a stumpy white barrel.
"You tell him, Aristotle," my father boomed in an accent as thick as yogurt. "George, you want to make it big into pizza business, you got to think big."
A gold tooth gleamed over Pa's shoulder, and my mother, a slim lady who wore a black dress and her pepper and salt hair pinned back in a neat bun, edged in. My mother is related to half the people on Crete. Relatives are always dying, and consequently she enjoys a perpetual state of mourning. Miraculously, she can spend a whole day in the bakery without getting a speck of flour on her dress.
"You listen to George," she yelled in Pop's ear. 5,000 linguica is too much."
"Hello, Ma," I said.
"Hello, Aristotle,"
she replied, treating me with a sweet smile that lasted a second
before she turned on my father and unleashed a torrent of Hellenic invective that would have impressed the avenging Furies. George looked smug.
That's right, Sock, old boy. Harvard didn't give you all the answers.
Boston University, George. Harvard's on the other side of the Charles River.
Charles Schmarls, it's all the same.
He was scraping off the flour caked onto his pinky ring. You're right, George. Absolutely correct. As usual, I'd only been home 3 minutes and my voice was already rising. I don't know a damn thing about pizzas except that they give me indigestion. You're probably right about the linguica, too. But do we all have to yell about it? My parents stopped screaming. They looked at me, dumbfounded. Pa shrugged and stomped back into the bakery. He was shaking his bald head, wiping his hands on his apron and muttering,
"You want a thing small? We thing small."
Beaming with vindication, George followed, slamming the door behind him, and I was left alone with my mother. We stood in silence a minute. Then I said,
"I'm sorry, Ma. I didn't mean to lose my temper. George just drives me crazy sometimes."
"George is a good boy, Aristotle. He works hard, comes in every day, and keeps the company going."
I don't think she meant to hurt me, but her words cut right to the quick. Maybe that's why I get so angry. I don't contribute a thing to the family. Heck, I can't even sing the Parthenon pizza jingle. My mother is relatively tall for her generation, but the top of her head comes just to my chin. I've never known her to be intimidated by a difference in height, or anything for that matter. She faced me square on, put her left hand on her hip, and wagged her right forefinger under my nose. Her gray eyes flashed.
"Aristotle," she scolded, "you make me very angry when you talk like that. The family is not the same as the business. George is like your father, an Athenian. To him, business is everything. You could never make pizza. You are too much like your great-grandfather Nikos."
She shook her head.
"Every time I look at you, I see him. He was tall like you, same hair, same sleepy smile, and the eyes. Sometimes warm and innocent like a little boy, sometimes like dark pools with no bottom."
She patted me lightly on the cheek.
"Sit down, Aristotle."
Easing into a leather chair, I pondered how little I really knew about my ancestors. For the most part, they were simply faded sepia photos of countless anonymous aunts, uncles, and cousins whose unsmiling faces seemed chiseled from the rocky terrain behind them. Their names were inevitably linked to disasters, drowning, falling, or wandering off never to be seen again tales that became object lessons to kids inclined toward disregarding the warnings of their parents. My great-grandfather was different, however. He loomed larger than life in the family mythology. In the dog-eared photo albums, he was a kindly-looking old codger with an eagle nose and a walrus mustache. He wore baggy black pants tucked into shiny black leather boots and a black fringed handkerchief on his head. I remember being fascinated by the antique pistols and the ivory-hilted dagger with its silver sheath stuck in his wide waistband and the bandolier across his chest, but never thought of them as more than photographer's props. My mother seated herself on the office sofa and folded her hands in her lap.
"When I was a little girl," she began, "I was my grandfather's favorite. He was old then, but still strong enough to lift heavy stones. I was like a tiny feather sitting on his knees. He told me stories of the old gods. He took me to the cave where Zeus was born and to Knossos where King Minos lived. Everywhere we went, people recognized Pawpaw and treated him with respect. I was so proud to be seen with him."
She paused thoughtfully.
"After he died, and I am old enough to understand, the family tells me more. How Nikos is a farmer when the Turks hold Crete. He is a peaceful man who minds his own business. Then one day, a neighbor comes and says, 'Help me, the Turks take my son.' So Nikos goes to help. There is a fight, and he kills 2 Turks. He escapes and becomes a hunted man living in the mountains. Then he becomes the hunter. He kills the Turks who come to catch him. They kill some of the family, and the others must hide. Grandfather becomes a devil. He strikes and is gone. Turkish mothers tell their children Nikos will come if they are bad."
She stopped again, a distant look in her eyes.
"When I heard these stories, I think about his hands, so big yet so gentle. I remember how they hold me, braid my hair, pick me up when I fall. But Aristotle,
she said, her expression growing more intense, her voice almost a whisper.
These were the hands that had killed men, cut off their ears and noses, and did other terrible, terrible things. Even today, when I think of how those hands do both good and evil, it frightens me.
I took her hand and squeezed it. Don't worry, Ma, I said. I may look like Nikos, but that's as far as it goes. I never did anything like that, not even in Vietnam. She touched my knee lightly.
I know, Aristotle, you are gentle too, but you are also like your grandfather, a palikari, a strong man. I could see when you were very young, that time the big boys picked on your brother and you put one of them in the hospital. That's why I push you into the university. Maybe if you study, you will become a professor.
She shook her head.
But blood always tells. First you become a soldier, then a policeman.
And now I'm a fisherman and a private investigator with 2 cents to his name. She took my hand in hers and squeezed it.
Sometimes you help people, no?
Sometimes I do, Ma.
Poof, then you are what you are.
I chuckled. Okay, Ma, you win, but I promise not to go near any Turks. We stood and she hugged me.
You're a good boy, Aristotle. You keep doing what you do and leave the linguica pizzas to George.
As if on cue, the door to the bakery opened and George walked in. He had washed up and changed into a tan summer suit and a pale blue sport shirt open at the collar. Around his neck he wore a thin gold chain that must have cost a bundle. When he's not covered with flour, George is a handsome man who turns female heads without trying. He has my dark brown hair and complexion. His nose is straighter, he's shorter by a couple of inches, and he wears his clothes with a Mediterranean jauntiness.
Let's go out for a beer, he said with unexpected friendliness. There's a terrific place open up near here.
In the interest of family harmony, I nodded, kissed my mother, promised on my life to call her soon, yelled goodbye to my father, who was busy in the bakery, and went outside. We got into George's car, a white Cadillac Elante convertible, about 2 blocks long, with a matching white top and a vanity license plate that read, Pizza. A few minutes later, we parked near a bistro that had more ferns in the window than a Tarzan movie. Inside, there were more ferns, a black, pink, and chrome Art Deco motif, and a long onyx bar crowded with successful-looking young urban professionals. The patrons, men and women, wore the kind of trendy, overpriced clothes sold in stores named after French poodles. They were talking at each other with animated expressions of earnest avarice. George was no stranger here. He glad-handed the line of suits as if he were running for mayor before we sat in a booth with a mirror on the wall so we could see how terrifically good-looking we were. The waiter introduced himself to me by his first name, which I thought was Forward. George ordered an imported beer that sounded like something a German says when a person sneezes. I asked our waiter for a Bud in a bottle and thought he was going to faint with mortification, which would have been all right with me. George wasted no time getting to what was on his mind. As soon as our beers arrived, he said,
Sock, I really feel funny talking to my older brother like this, but when the hell are you going to settle down and make something out of your life?
I resisted the primal urge to reach out and rip the self-satisfied smile off his cocksure face. Instead, I said, By the way, George, how's Maria and little Jimmy and Ariadne?
They're good, Sock, real good. That's another thing you should be thinking of. A wife and kids. Hell, you're still a young guy.
He waved expansively.
Look at me. I've got friends and business associates. I've got a 5-bedroom house outside of town and a swimming pool shaped like a pizza. We've got 3 caddies in the garage, all with car phones, and only 2 people to drive them. I've got an exercise room and a media room loaded with state-of-the-art toys I don't know how to operate. I even vote Republican. Tell me, Sock, what have you got? Wait a second, I'll tell you. You've got nothing.
My hand clenched the flaring Pilsner glass. George, I want you to stop right there before I forget you're my brother. You're way out of line. George leaned back, a look of embarrassment on his flushed face, and put his palms out. He'd gone too far, and he knew it.
Okay, I'll shut up. I was just thinking about your welfare.
Don't. I appreciate your concern, but what I do or do not do with my life is my business, nobody else's. If I want to screw it up, that's my business. If I want to waste it, that's my business, too. We finished our beers in a tense silence that wasn't broken until a short while later when George drove me back to my truck. "Say goodbye to the folks for me," I said, getting out of the Cadillac, "and thanks for the beer." I slammed the car door, got into my truck, and nearly ripped the gear lever off the steering post. I shouldn't have let George get to me, but his pompous posturings contained splinters of truth that got under my skin. George could never understand me, not in 1,000 years. Hell, I don't even understand myself. Even so, his well-meant counsel had started embers of resentment burning in my soul. I was still seething 45 minutes later when I pulled into Harvard Square. The prospect of a long, uninterrupted ride home alone with my thoughts was too much to bear, so I decided to head into Cambridge and stop off at a Mexican restaurant for a frozen margarita or two and a couple of tacos. I like Mexican food, but it doesn't like me, and I looked forward to a little stomach distress to divert me from my broodings. There's a Mex cantina off the square I frequented when I was at Boston Cop. It's a noisy place, smelling of tequila and onions, and usually jammed with Harvard kids whose innocent rowdiness used to be like a tonic to me when I was coming off some dreary case. I guess I was looking for a dose of the same medicine. The tangle of narrow streets around the square is a parking nightmare any time of the day or night. I prowled for 10 minutes before I saw a car leaving a space near the restaurant. I pulled ahead, started to back in, and slammed on my brakes. A blue Toyota Tercel was hugging my bumper. I leaned on the horn and, when the car didn't move, threw the truck into reverse and mashed the accelerator. The Toyota backed up so quickly it tapped the bumper of the car in line behind it. I parked, got out of the truck without a look back, and went directly to the bar inside the cantina. The bartender was a half dozen drink orders behind and trying to catch up. Minutes passed. I was becoming cranky. A tall, slim woman took the stool next to me. Her shoulder-length red hair glinted like copper in the light. It was obvious from the way she waved a $5 bill that she was thirsty, too. I finally caught the bartender's eye and testily yelled out that I wanted a margarita. The red-haired woman shouted her order at the same time, a glass of white Zinfandel. Figured. I turned to give her an annoyed glance. She beat me to the punch, skewering me with a glare that didn't take away from the fact that she had remarkable blue eyes and was quite attractive. I shrugged and finally got my order in. When my margarita arrived in its salt-rimmed glass, I attempted to drink it in peace. The red-haired woman had other ideas. She'd been stewing. "You know you almost hit me back there," she said pointedly. I gave her a blank look. "I was right behind you. You backed up so damn fast I bumped into the car behind me." The blue Toyota. I yawned. "You shouldn't have been so close to my tail." "You shouldn't be behind the wheel of anything bigger than a tricycle." "Look, little lady." "I'm not little, and I'm not a lady." "I can see that," I said, and slammed the glass down without breaking it. No amount of refried beans was worth having to listen to a lecture from a woman who was probably a spoiled and overeducated grad student. I slid off my stool, threw some bills on the bar, and stormed out of the restaurant, cursing softly when I got to my truck. There was the blue Toyota kissing my rear bumper. I got into the pickup, threw the gear shift into first, and smashed into the car ahead of me. Then I put it in reverse and crunched the Toyota. After a few satisfying minutes, I had pounded out several inches of elbow room. I banged at the Toyota one more time, squeezed out another inch, and eased onto the street. I thought I heard a yell and looked in the rearview mirror. The red-haired woman was standing on the sidewalk waving at me. I waved back and drove off. About 2 hours later, I pulled up in front of the boathouse. I had stopped on the way home for a wholesome Big Mac and fries. My mood had improved with the weather. The rain had stopped completely. The wind had died to a light breeze that sighed in the locust trees. The stars sparkled like 14-carat diamonds in the black sky. "Hello, Big Dipper," I said. "Thought I'd never see you again." The boathouse still smelled like a penicillin factory, but that would disappear with a few days of sunlight and open windows. I set the alarm for 4 a.m. and went directly to bed. Sam would be down on the shore first thing in the morning, and I didn't want to keep him waiting.